Just give us an idea, Graham. How's it been this week preparing this talk?
Very, very difficult.
And just, people might not know, how long does it take you in a week?
Well, it varies massively, actually, depending on the passage and depending on what else is going on in life, really. So sometimes it just isn't that long. and it's as good as it is by Sunday. So this week, I think I spent a couple of hours on Tuesday morning, and I think I spent most of Thursday morning and a bit of Friday morning, and I'm still not very happy.
So 10 hours, 12 hours?
Something like that, yeah. But so sometimes you feel like you understand the passage and it kind of falls out. Other times you really wrestle and kind of struggle over it. So it does vary quite a lot.
I was just trying to do a sum working out how many hours of preparation for a minute of talking, but my maths.
Yeah. But you're a maths teacher.
Yeah, I know. let me just pray. Father, thank you for this work that Graham's put in this week. We pray that by your Spirit you would quicken these words into our hearts and minds. And we pray in the same way that we would be receptive to those words. Please help us not to just phase out or to let our minds wander, but to concentrate, to use our minds, and to be open. Father, we want to be changed into your likeness, and we know that it's by your word that you build your people. So we do pray for these next few minutes together. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much. Well, that's actually anticipated how I was going to start, which is to say I've really struggled this week. I'll point out the bits where I sort of still have questions and tell you kind of where I've got to. But I'm not sure if you find that encouraging or depressing, but our understanding of the Bible is always a work in progress. That's true for me, as it's true for anybody. And one of our jobs as a church is to work together and help each other in understanding things more. Anyway, I'll point out some bits in a second. Our family sometimes goes to boot fairs, where we look through lots of people's junk. We occasionally get a bargain and go home very pleased with ourselves, but we mostly go home with other people's junk. And we've paid them for the privilege of it. Occasionally, we actually take stuff. Once we've taken stuff and tried to sell it ourselves, in which case it just becomes a junk exchange program where we sell some of our junk and they pay us for it, but we manage still to have a full car as we leave as we've picked up other people's rubbish. Anyway, sometimes at a boot fair, the big boot fairs, you spot the traders, the professionals. You can always tell the difference because rather than, you know, one cracked vase that they're trying to sell, they have 50 of them. You didn't just find those in the garage, did you? You know. And sometimes they're selling imitation goods. The vase, the jewellery, the watches, the clothing, whatever it is not the real thing. It looks fine at first glance, of course. The bottle of the perfume is the right shape, has the right logo, clothing has the right sort of design and so on, but it's just an imitation. It's fake goods. And when you look at it closely, and certainly if you start to wear it, use it, or whatever, you realize it is nothing like the real thing. Well, I think in this passage of Luke, Jesus is worried about imitation disciples. Imitation disciples. He's been teaching in this whole section about how people should live life following him. It all started back in chapter 6, verse 20. This kicked the whole thing off. Looking at his disciples, he said. And he's been teaching them ever since. We just have one long sermon that we've divided up into about three chunks. And he's spoken to them about their attitude to this world, about living for God and so on, being prepared to suffer now. We saw last week how he called us to reflect God's heart of love to the world around us, even loving our enemies. And he finishes the whole thing off, I think, with this challenge where he warns people about being imitations, about being forgery Christians. I think he gets people to ask themselves two very simple questions. Now, the first one is, what sort of fruit am I producing? What fruit am I producing? Verse 43, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. You don't pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A couple of related pictures, but the point's the same. First one's the good tree and the bad tree. You know, one is rotten with some tree disease of some kind that I don't know about, and it produces dodgy fruit as a result. We have a plum tree in our garden. Fruit looked very nice last year. Go and pick it. You think, oh, I wonder what that's actually like, and you break it open. It's kind of all maggoty and revolting inside. I presume the thing's got some kind of disease. I don't know. Whereas a healthy tree produces good fruit. Well, the second picture is that the type of tree determines the type of fruit. Yeah, we've got these plum trees and a couple of apple trees and things, but I don't walk down the garden wondering one morning if they might produce us some bananas. You know, I know that's not going to happen. Well, so says Jesus, you don't pick figs from thorn bushes. Thorn bushes can't produce figs. Well, they're pretty obvious examples. But his point is, in both cases, it's the nature of the tree, good or bad, fig or thorn, it's the nature of the tree that determines the nature of the fruit. The fruit shows you what sort of tree it's like. And the point is in verse 45. Good people bring good things out of the good stored up in their heart, and evil people bring evil things out of the evil stored up in their heart. Just like the nature of the tree determines the nature of the produce, so the nature of a person's heart determines what comes out of them, what they do, what they say in particular. See how it finishes? For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. I think Jesus says that because he's just been talking about how people speak to each other, condemning language, hypocritical language, and so on. What comes out of your lips reveals what is in your heart. The produce of our lives shows our true colours. Now, the first thing I want to do is just to think about how this basic principle compares to the way we tend to think, or at least the world around us would tend to think. Jesus says, your actions reveal your heart. How does that compare with how the world around us would tend to think about doing bad things, say? Any ideas? A bit of feedback? People do a bad thing, what they tend to say about it? Yeah, so. So it depends. So first of all, is it a bad thing in the first place? Because bad is usually only if it hurts somebody. Let's suppose it does hurt somebody, so it is a truly bad thing. What conclusions do people draw about themselves from that? Yeah.
It's often circumstantial, so it's because you're tired, you're not feeling well, or feeling sick.
Yeah.
That's why you're not doing good.
Yeah, it's circumstances. I said that because I'm tired. I'm under pressure at work today, or something. Anything else? Yeah, Mark.
People can justify what they do. So even if it's bad, people can justify it to some extent.
Yeah, so you somehow justify it, maybe through the circumstances, maybe through some other rationale. You said that, and I was thinking about this, and that's why I responded the way I did, or so on. Anything else? Okay.
So you said you look at people and say they're not a bad
person. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? I'm not a bad person, I just do bad things occasionally. What does Jesus say? No, your fruit shows you for what you are. You know, we tend to say, well, you know, I'm not perfect. Well, quite often actually we say, I'm not perfect, but deep down I'm good. Whereas Jesus actually says, well, no, the deeper down you go, the worse it gets. That's where the problem is, deep down, in your heart. What the world tends to do is say, well, we do rubbish stuff sometimes, but then we sort of distance ourselves from it. That wasn't really me. Say things like that. I didn't mean it, or it was the circumstances. I justify it. But Jesus says we are like what we produce. That's why we produce it. And so the evil we produce should make us very worried about the state of our hearts. I'll give you another illustration about the world around us. We started the parenting seminar just last week. In one of our little groups, someone mentioned a playgroup. Either their child went to or the playgroup they knew of anyway, where they'd say that what a child had done was naughty. But they would not say, they were not allowed as a playgroup, policy statement, they were not allowed to say that the child was naughty. So you've done a naughty thing. But they weren't allowed to say, you are naughty. See the difference? Draw a distinction between what comes out and the nature of the person themselves. And so the first of all, I just want to point out how brutally honest and direct Jesus is here, particularly compared to the world today. Now that's just, first of all, an observation on this principle Jesus is using. But how does Jesus apply it here? This is where it gets a little more tricky and where I have my questions. You see, he applies it in absolute terms. Good people and bad people exist in the world, he says. Good people bring good things out, evil people bring evil things out. And you can know whether they're good or bad by the produce of their lives. Well, given the context, I think what he is saying is you can tell the difference between the real and the imitation disciple, the follower of Jesus, by looking at their fruit. The problem we have with this is talking in absolute terms. And you may be thinking to yourself, well, I produce a bit of a mixture, actually. There's some good, I trust, and there's some bad sometimes. What does that mean for me then? Am I a good-bad tree? Well, this is still, as I say, where I have my questions. I'll tell you where I've got to so far. I think that there's some quite significant Old Testament background to this, which Jesus doesn't mention, and so I want to be cautious, but I do think his listeners may well have been thinking of it. Particularly where Israel, God's people in the Old Testament, are pictured as a vineyard themselves. It was at the period of time that we were looking at in our Bible overview, in our all-age slot, where the country as a whole was turning against God, rebelling against him as king. And God, in Isaiah 5, talks about Israel being a vineyard and then says, but they only produced bad fruit. But when God said that about them and used that picture of them, he didn't mean like up to that point they were absolutely perfect and suddenly they started to do things wrong. And he certainly didn't mean that at this point in their history they were occasionally doing the wrong thing and therefore they must be a rotten tree sort of thing. Now what was going on, this bad fruit they were producing, was that their heart was turned against him. And so they produced bad fruit, rebelling against him, pushing him off as king, just as we were thinking earlier on. So in that Old Testament example, it's not simply about doing the wrong thing occasionally, as it were. It's more about the direction of their heart and the whole resulting life they lived. So, of course, it showed itself in what they did. But if you like, it wasn't a case of, unless you're perfect, unless you're never put a foot wrong, you must be a rotten tree. That's what I'm thinking about with this. I want to be very careful about watering this down in any way. But I think Jesus is talking about the direction of our hearts and the way that shows itself in life. Rather than kind of going one bit of bad fruit on a tree, therefore the whole tree must be rotten. The other bit of Old Testament background I think would be in people's minds is God's promise to give people a new heart. He said in Jeremiah and in Ezekiel that he would renew people's hearts. He'd give them a heart that loved him, a heart that loved to obey him, a heart that loved what was right and good, rather than a heart that produced evil. And so I don't think this is about saying, well, there are some people in the world who are just really nice, upstanding, good people, and other people are just evil. And Christians are good, nice people. No, I think this means everyone should be very aware of the evil their heart produces and knows that God needs to renew them and give them a new heart to produce good. Well, that's some Old Testament background. The bottom line in what Jesus is saying is a closer look at people reveals their true nature. Maybe in this band of followers around him, people would have looked pretty similar, standing in the crowd, listening to his teaching. Maybe in a church, people will look, first sight, pretty similar in what they do, in attendance and so on. And Jesus is saying, a look at the fruit of someone's life tells you what they're really made of. And this is why elsewhere in the New Testament we're told that our actions reveal the truthfulness of our profession. James, for example, says that if our faith has no works with it, if it makes no difference in the way we live, it's dead. John tells us in his letter that our love for each other and our fight against sin reveals that we truly belong to God and that we have new hearts. Paul tells us that Jesus redeemed us to create a people who were eager to do what is good. Our profession must be matched by a change in life, a change in fruit. This is why if someone's actions don't match up to their profession of faith, we can and indeed may go as far as saying we don't think they're a true Christian, a true disciple of Jesus. Someone who is producing evil and not turning from it, continuing in it, such that as you look at their life, you have to say, your heart is set against God. You are producing evil here. They can and should be told they can't be considered one of Jesus' disciples because of the fruit they are showing. Now, maybe you're sitting here this morning and you're thinking, well, that might be me. I'm not a Christian, or I'm not sure I'm a Christian. And I know my heart produces evil. Can I tell you, you need to turn to Jesus and ask him for forgiveness because of his death. Ask him to give you that new heart and start to live a life producing that good. Or maybe you're sitting here and you're pretty sure you are a Christian, but you're feeling slightly unsettled because of this. Well, do I produce enough good and so on? Well, can I ask you, just looking back at Jesus' words earlier, do you try and love people? Do you try and love them even when they don't deserve it from you? Do you pray for others, even if that's hard for you sometimes? Look to bless them rather than curse them? If the curse creeps out, do you regret it, turn from it, turn to pray for them? In other words, is your heart direction trying to live out and produce this fruit that Jesus has been speaking about? If the answer is yes, then I want to say be reassured. You are showing the good fruit that Jesus is talking about. Well, we may long to produce it more, and we should, and we ask for his help, and we mourn the lack of it, but we can be reassured that it is there. What fruit are we producing? Second question Jesus gives people is what they are building on. See, the second picture Jesus gives he moves from the fruit trees and talks about building. Verse 46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" You see his concern here. See who Jesus is talking about? He's concerned for those who are listening, who are going to honour him in some way. They're going to say, Lord. They'll call him Lord. They'll honour him, speak well of him, say they think highly of him. But do not do what he says. They bear the name Christian. They make the profession, but they're not the real thing. And again, it's shown by their actions. They don't do what Jesus tells them to. It's the problem of the fruit tree, just expressed in a different way. Now here, it's very much on our response to Jesus' words. See verse 47. Those who come to me, probably thinking of those coming out to him as he teaches, those in the crowd, and those who hear my words and put them into practice, I'll show you what they are like. They're like the person who builds a house, digs deep, lays the foundation, and so on. We'll come back to that. As opposed to verse 49, those who come and hear my words and do not put them into practice. This is the person who just says, Lord, Lord. Oh, they come and stand in the crowd and say, have you heard Jesus? He's brilliant. I love to follow him. Just great he is. But they don't do what he says. Or the person who sits in church, but sits loose to Jesus' teaching. Sing songs of worship about him, but don't bow before him and obey him. This is lip service. And this time, Jesus focuses on the ultimate difference that this kind of imitation will make. He speaks about this flood coming. See, they each build a house. They are like a man who builds a house. One of them digs deep and builds on the rock, lays a foundation. The second one in verse 49, the person who just says, Lord, Lord, where it's all lip service and it's empty. They're like someone who builds a house, but it's on the ground without a foundation. And in both cases, the flood comes. The torrent strikes the house. Well, many people have said that this flood represents the storms of life, the trials and tribulations we will go through, and the person who truly follows Jesus and does what he says will not be knocked around by the trials of life. They'll stand firm, whereas the person who's the lip service Christian will be flattened by them. Well, I guess I want to say that I think there's some truth in that, but I don't think that's really what Jesus is talking about. I say there's some truth in that, in the sense that our trusting and following Jesus, of course, helps us in the hardships of life. But I don't think that's what's been spoken about here, because the difference between these two is dramatic and total. One house stands firm, we read, and the torrent cannot shake it, whereas the other one falls flat and its destruction is complete. Well, the fact is, Christians are shaken by the trials of life. There's no point saying that otherwise. And the fact is, many non-Christians are not knocked off their feet by the trials of life. There's no point saying that isn't the case either. So I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about. The image of the flood or the storm is used in the Old Testament as a picture of God's judgment coming. One passage in Ezekiel, for example, the judgment is pictured as a storm with torrents of rain, and the people God is talking to are actually doing this Lord, Lord stuff. They're going through the motions of living for God. There's no real obedience, there's no heart for God here. And God pictures them in that passage in Ezekiel as a flimsy wall that is nicely painted. So it looks all right, But when the flood hits it, it is knocked flat. When the storm of God's judgment comes, they cannot stand before it. And so here, I think, the difference between this guy who digs deep and lays his foundation and the other one with no foundation at all, the difference is when the storm of judgment comes. You can tell the difference between the real thing and the imitation disciple now because you can see the fruit in their life. But Jesus wants to warn us of the ultimate difference it will make. We actually have a choice, Jesus is saying. We can stand firm in the face of God's judgment, or we can be knocked over by it and collapse. And you decide between those options now. You decide between those future possibilities in how you respond to Jesus now. Whether you honour him and obey him, listening to what he tells you to do and putting it into practice, or if you just speak well of him. And so I think Jesus is calling people to a kind of self-examination. He's speaking to those people in verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Why do you do that? Because this is what your future will be. And he's calling them to respond fully and totally to him. The person who knows that Jesus calls them to love, but who will only ever hold on to hate. The person who knows Jesus calls them to generosity and goodness to all around them, but says, no, my money and my time are all mine, and I'm not giving them away. The person who knows Jesus calls them to forgiveness but holds on to bitterness, saying, I won't let it go. The person who knows Jesus calls them to self-control but says, I know, it's fine to get drunk, I don't care. The person who knows Jesus calls them to sexual purity but says, well, I love my boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever, so I do what I like with them. And so on and so on. The person who says, Lord, Lord, to Jesus, and here's what he says, but does not do it. And I just want to humbly ask whether that is you this morning. Because if it is, Jesus wants to warn you. He wants to ask you, why do you do that when this is the future? I'll show you what you're like, he says. You are like this man. And your destruction will be complete. Turn to Jesus and ask him to forgive you. Ask him to change you. And start to do what he says. And if you're someone trying to do that, and you're very aware of how imperfectly you do it, but you're trying to live as Jesus wants, and you're sorry when you fail, and you're looking to live for him and looking to obey him, Jesus wants to say, I'll show you what you're like. You're like this person digging a deep foundation onto the rock, and when the flood comes, it won't be able to shake you. Not because you're so great, because you're a brilliant person, but because you've built your life on me. You've listened to me. And so be reassured. You will not be shaken on that day. So there are real disciples and there are imitation disciples. The great danger I felt this week is that I might reassure someone who really ought to be worried about their position with Jesus, and I might worry someone who really ought to be reassured. That's my great worry about this morning. I really hope I haven't done that. I've tried to be as clear as I can be. Ultimately, I think we each need to reflect and say, what fruit am I producing and what am I building on? Let's have a moment's quiet, shall we? A moment's quiet reflection and ask ourselves those questions. Okay, we've got a few moments. Why don't I take my life in my hands and we'll have any time for a couple of questions or contributions. If you have an insight that would be helpful for us, or an application, or anything really that would enrich our thinking, or a question you'd like to ask, throw a hand in the air and we'll see how we go. Yeah.
You said that it's important that we should be aware that we need a new heart.
Yeah.
And like, when do we get that heart? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. Brilliant. We need a new heart. When do we get it? How does that work? I think we get that as we first turn to Jesus and trust in him. It's something described much more in the letters. So, for example, Paul talks about the washing of rebirth and renewal by the Spirit in Titus 3. I think that's describing the new birth, the new heart in us. I think Jesus speaks about it most obviously in John 3, when he speaks about being born again. And the language he uses there about being born by water and the Spirit is picking up language in Ezekiel about God's new covenant, his new work where he'll wash people with water and put his Spirit in them and give them that new life. So I think that happens as we turn to Christ. We then have this kind of what I've sometimes described as a slightly schizophrenic existence as a Christian, where we still feel the pull of the old nature, but we also have a heart that produces good. And that's the real us now that is to continue to produce this good fruit.
I have some concerns that you could go away from this feeling quite work. It's quite worksy. It's about if I'm good, I'll be saved, and if I'm bad, I won't.
Yeah.
I think that made time for what Rachel was saying about
yeah. Yeah, thank you. Caris was saying this could feel quite worksy. That is that we are right with God, accepted by God, can stand before him on the judgment day because of what we've done. I don't think that's the case for two reasons. One is because we need this new heart before we can produce anything good in the first place. So that actually is a gift from God, a work that he's done in us. So I can't boast about my good works because they're only there because he's renewed me. Secondly, I think what Jesus is talking about is our good works are kind of evidence. It's evidence for the state of our heart and evidence for what we're building on, whether we're trusting Christ and obeying him. It's not the basis on which we're right with God. As we were thinking, as Chris was leading us in our reflections, we're right with God because Jesus died for us. There's nothing we contribute to that. Please, please hear that clearly. Don't think that's what I'm saying. If you think I'm saying we're right with God, what we do, I'm not. But I do think our actions are then evidence. And that's why I mentioned there's other verses from James and John and so on where I think our works are looked to as evidence of the new heart in us.
So it's like the rich young ruler, isn't it? Where he says that I've done all this right from the beginning of my life.
Yeah.
And Jesus says, well, I want you to follow me.
Yeah.
And he turns it the other way around. That isn't what about what he's done. He's been wonderful.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. The rich young ruler says, I've done brilliantly well, haven't I? And Jesus says, come and follow me. Now, in that example, he won't follow Jesus because he loves his money too much. So ultimately, in a sense, it's an evidence thing. How do you know he's not right with God? Because the evidence is he wouldn't turn from his money. That's not that someone else who turned from the money must be all right with God, because it depends why they're doing it. So it's about our heart and our trust. But our actions show the evidence of it. Yeah, Ruth.
That short passage in James says, but some will say one person has faith, another has actions. My answer is, show me how anyone can have faith without actions. I will show you my faith by my actions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think that's exactly, that's another way of looking at exactly what we're talking about in terms of faith showing itself in its actions. And if it doesn't have any actions to it, he uses the illustration of a body which has no life and no action to it, and he says that body is dead. And so it's only a profession of faith, not the real thing. Phil, last one.
Just a thought. What about a non-Christian who appears to be doing lots of good things? You know, yeah. It's how kind of linked into spiritual state of this passage?
Yeah, what about then a non-Christian person who seems to live quite a good life and produce good stuff? Yeah. Well, I think there we have to say that obviously lots of people can do things that in and of themselves are kind of objectively good or kind or something. But goodness, I think in the Bible, is only ever defined with regard to God. You know, the ultimate commandment is to love God with my heart. And that will show itself in my life. And so, in one sense, it doesn't really matter what I decide to do. If my heart motivation has got nothing to do with God, then actually what I'm producing is bad, even if it might be a kind action in and of itself. Quick illustration. Two people who both think the speed limit is rubbish and hate the government for having enforced a speed limit and say, I will drive the speed I want to drive, right? Two people, identical attitudes, in rebellion to the authority. One drives at 100, one drives at 25. Well, one is kind of obeying the law. But is their attitude actually any different to the other person? No. So similarly, some people do kind of objectively good things, but what's their attitude to God? That's the question, I think. We should finish. That's just got you thinking. Do carry on those conversations.